Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording September 8, 2021, we're continuing our series examining the defense commitments made by the three main national parties in their 2021 election platforms. Joining us today is the Conservative Party of Canada's Defense Shadow Minister and candidate for Selkirk Interlake Eastman, James Bazan. This podcast is brought to you by Irving Shipbuilding. Mr. Bazan, welcome back to Defense Deconstructed.
Thanks for having me back.
So let's get rolling right away. Start us off by talking about how, if you form government, the Conservative Party of Canada will approach defense and national security.
Well, I think it's first and foremost, we're going to provide the leadership that's been sorely lacking over the last 6 years under the Trudeau government. We're definitely going to talk about and focus in on getting the equipment that the brave women and men who serve in the Canadian Armed Forces so desperately need, treat them with the respect they deserve, create the safe work environment that they want, and really prioritize defending Canadian territory, especially our Arctic. I think the Arctic strategy that we have in our platform and bolstering our defense presence up there and investing in the equipment that we need to operate in that space is something that everyone has been waiting for and has been sorely lacking under this Liberal government.
Okay, so let's take through some of the commitments in the platform, kind of in the order that you just touched on them there, and talk about equipment and some aspects of procurement. You're proposing to make some changes to the procurement system. Talk a little bit about those and why you're putting forward those specific proposals to address procurement issues.
Well, what we've witnessed over the past several years is that the Liberals have habitually, delayed and dithered on making any decisions on major procurement. The best that they've been able to do is buy a bunch of old rusted out Australian fighter jets that are the same vintage of the current fleet of CF-18s that we have. We will actually have a minister responsible for defense procurement. So there will be a minister appointed that will concentrate on delivering and have true power to make these decisions so that we can get the kit that is desperately needed in the armed forces. You look at how the national shipbuilding strategy has become continually tied up in the changing dimensions that the Liberals have brought into play, and it just continues to delay and make the replacement of our Navy ships even more expensive. So everything from getting our surface combatants built and the joint supply ships, those things have just dragged on for far too long. By having a Minister of Defense Procurement being solely responsible and accountable to the armed forces, to Canadians, and to Parliament will expedite this process and allow us to really narrow down on who at cabinet is going to be making those decisions. The thing that we need to keep in mind is that we are going to make the investments required to get towards that NATO 2% aspirational target so that we can finally start meeting what is expected of us as a lot reliable partner within the alliance, and one that the Americans under multiple governments now of saying that, we need to make sure that everybody is paying their fair share and pulling their weight when it comes to our collective defense. And so that includes NORAD and NATO.
And another aspect of the campaign's platform commitment related to procurement is to use the National Defense Committee of the House of Commons differently. What would you try and do with the NDDN?
So the thing that has always struck me is that procurement has become way too political, especially with the Liberals, from everything from saying that they, Trudeau, without having proper intelligence or briefing on any of our procurement projects, said that he had just canceled the F-35 outright without knowing what he was talking about. We want to make sure that when procurement projects are going forward, that all parties have had a chance to have that input into what equipment is required, what manufacturers are out there that are bidding on these contracts, and it provides that sounding board, which the National Defense Committee actually has the capability of doing, and one that I've been sitting on that committee for 10 years now, and know that it has been underutilized by the Liberals in actually briefing them, providing those technical briefings on what procurement projects come forward, what theaters of operation our forces going into, and what is required to keep our troops safe and do the job that they've been asked to do. So we want to ensure that the National Defense Committee has a chance to provide input and take the politics out of national defense.
And the final aspect of your kind of procurement discussion in the platform is prioritizing a number of procurements. So there's a commitment on fast-tracking the selection of new fighter jets through the current competition, and then an enumerated a list of basically all Navy projects. So the ones for the National Shipbuilding Strategy, the Surface Combatant Project, Icebreakers, Joint Support Ship, ordering Obelix to, as a second follow-on as a contracted interim refueler, beginning the process of replacing the Victoria class, and then procuring two armed heavy icebreakers for the RCN, which maybe we can hold and talk about as part of your Arctic commitments. But just briefly, why identifying the priorities on those projects and why that list of projects and not some of the other ones?
Well, I think that first and foremost, it is our Royal Canadian Navy that has been allowed to atrophy for far too long. The lifespan of our current frigates is ticking down quite rapidly, even with the life extension projects that were done under the previous Conservative government. We know that we have to get these projects moving forward. So surface combatants, joint supply ships have to be delivered. And, you know, in the interim, yeah, well, the Asterix has been an amazing supply ship as a AOR. We need to have more of that capability in the interim so that we are a true blue water fleet. So wanting to bring in the Obelix, which, you know, if it can do the same work that the Asterix has done, it'd be a welcome addition to the Royal Canadian Navy. You know, the fighter jet issue has dragged on for far too long. That one needs, that decision has to be made. The full competition has been run. Again, Liberals in typical fashion are dithering and delaying and sitting on those bids. It's time to make the decision and get the best possible aircraft or platforms for our Air Force. And of course, that means being able to interoperable with our NATO and NORAD allies. And we have to move forward on that as quickly as possible. You know, just reading this morning how Norway's taken, you know, three more F-35s in their procurement process. Italy has a you know, new fleet of fighter aircraft. You know, everybody's upgrading and moving into the next generation fighters, and we're still sitting here with our CF-18s, and the best Liberals could do is buy a bunch of worn out F-18s from Australia. And, you know, that isn't inspiring anyone to come and join the Royal Canadian Air Force. You know, we know that we're dealing with a major pilot shortage, and part of the problem is nobody wants to fly a bunch of old kit. We need to get the better equipment out there and do the task at hand, which is not just patrolling Canadian airspace and being able to intercept Russian bear bombers and other aircraft coming into our airspace in the Arctic and elsewhere in the North American airspace. But also providing that support on an international basis when NATO and our other allies are requiring more of Canada, not less.
So you just talked about a particular personnel issue related to retention in pilots. So let's switch gears and talk about some of the people commitments. And I guess I'd sort of break out the platform commitments into three buckets. One is about recruiting retention. Another component about the quality of life for personnel in the forces. And I think the third kind of category is conduct and dealing with harassment. So tackle those in any order that you want, but what would the Conservative Party of Canada do for the personnel in our armed forces?
Well, you know, it is our armed forces members who make us the what we are as a fighting force. They are the best of the best. And so we need to go out there and actively recruit those individuals. We need to expand the pool on where we pull those people from within their communities. We know, for example, case in point is cybersecurity and expanding the cyber command aspect of the armed forces and get it fully operational is we're going to need a different type of soldier than what we've used in the past. And that's where we see a lot of reserves as being the possibility there of filling those roles. partnering in with the cybersecurity industry here in Canada to find the right personnel, and so we can quickly stand up the cyber command aspects. And it, you know, the threats from cyber are getting more and more rapid in what is happening, you know, on a daily basis and an hourly basis as attacks against Canada. So we are saying that things like universality of service may be antiquated. You know, that every person in the Canadian Armed Forces has to be rifleman is something that is probably part of our past, especially as we look at cyber. And for those that have sustained injury in service to Canada, we need to find other ways to bring, keep them in the armed forces, especially after you look at the time and money that's spent in training these individuals. And some of them have incredible capabilities that can be used elsewhere than just being out on the field, or, you know, working on the deck of a ship, or, you know, working on a cargo plane. So, you know, there might be opportunities for other people to be retrained and moved into things like cyber and logistics and, you know, looking at the next war and how we fight it, rather than looking backwards at how we previously fought. So, you know, that's one of the areas that we have to go in. I think that's where we get the better retention, especially as people, you know, start moving down their career path within the armed forces. And we want to make sure that they stay in. Part of the training thing as well is that those that are in the skilled trades, let's give them red seals, so that when they do, you know, might be an attraction for more people to sign up, because they're going to get that equivalent training that they would if they stayed as a private citizen, and have that easier time of transitioning out at the time that they decide that they've served their country for as much as they could give, and are now going to be moving into their private lives. And so by being Red Seal, that means that they can take that trade and use it anywhere across the country. Really, you know, as we look at, you know, providing that increased workforce within the Canadian Armed Forces, we have to create the safe work environment for them as well. And, you know, what we witnessed under Trudeau and Minister Sagen turning a blind eye to sexual harassment within the Canadian Armed Forces by, you know, senior officers is something that was despicable. It really hurt the morale of the forces. It eroded trust within the public. And we have to reestablish that. And, you know, Aaron O'Toole has been very clear on this going back to February, saying that we have to put a freeze on all flag officer and command officer promotions to make sure that we are getting down to the bottom and changing the culture within the armed forces. And that includes bringing about an independent ombudsman within the Canadian Armed Forces and Department of National Defense, and having a true independent reporting process, so that the chain of command cannot interfere or intimidate those investigations, as we witnessed over the past several months. But it all comes down to a question of leadership at the political level. And what we saw from through this whole process is that Minister Sagen failed to act appropriately, failed to provide that leadership. And that's why, as Conservatives, we call for his resignation some time ago, and yet he still sits in the defense minister's chair. And during this campaign, we saw the Raj Sani sexual misconduct allegations that the Liberals, you know, the prime minister's office knew about for the past 6 years, and again turned a blind eye. So Liberals only have zero tolerance for sexual misconduct when it becomes news in the media. And until then, they'll always turn a blind eye, and we got to make sure that stops.
Now let's take a quick break to hear about one of our sponsors. In the next few months, Canada will select its next fighter aircraft that will help ensure the safety and security of Canadians and deliver economic benefits to industry. The next generation Block 3 Super Hornet is the best choice to take on Canada's most complex missions. It will also deliver more than 250,000 high-paying jobs and $61 billion to Canada's economy over the life of the program. This is nearly three times more than its competitors. It has also work that stays in Canada, guaranteed. Along with the economic benefits, the Super Hornet is the most efficient, affordable means of transitioning from Canada's existing CF-18s to a new platform. It is capable of performing the full range of tactical strike fighter missions required by the Royal Canadian Air Force at a much more affordable rate. For the Canadian men and women in uniform that will be flying this aircraft, it's important that they can execute their mission safely and return home each and every day. The Block 3 Super Hornet's two-engine design ensures safe operations over open sea, the Arctic, and other challenging environments. Whether it's today or tomorrow, Boeing will continue to be a partner to Canada well into the future. Switch gears from personnel and talk about some of the commitments that you've made in terms of different parts of the world. Let's start at home and within continental North America. There's commitments to modernize NORAD and update the North Warning System, but then a pretty extensive discussion about the Arctic and Arctic sovereignty. So maybe talk from a start with a North American perspective and then focus in particular on Canada's Arctic and what you would do there.
So we all know that the Americans have started the discussion on modernizing NORAD. And, you know, the threat environment has changed. The actors continue to evolve and interest by other great powers in the Arctic continues to evolve, whether it's Russia building up their military capabilities in their Arctic area or placing the Russian flag at the bottom of the Arctic Sea on top of the North Pole or China, which has, even growing Arctic Navy, the People's Liberation Army Navy of Communist China, continues to build icebreakers, and not just for research, but also for military use. They have at least a half dozen icebreakers now that are People's Liberation Army Navy, not research vessels, military vessels, and Canada and the United States needs to do more to protect the maritime and aerial domain of our Arctic zone. So that includes taking the North Warning System and upgrading it and expanding it to include all of the Arctic archipelagos, something that is long overdue and something the Liberals have failed to even discuss. You know, here we are 6 years into their mandate, and only in this last budget have they put in any funding for looking at NORAD modernization and updating North Warning System. And it's only like $20 or $25 million. It's nothing. It's going to cost billions to upgrade this system. And we're talking about looking at everything from expanding the radar sat constellation for more satellites, putting in low Earth orbit satellites for ongoing surveillance of our Arctic, using drones, basing them out of CFB Bagotville, and using those drones to provide that surveillance. And we need to look at that as a very cost effective and very efficient way with high efficacy in doing surveillance, has been proven around the world. Arctic, a little more harsh environment to work in, but one that we can definitely use drones in a much more expanded fashion, and one that Canada should be a leader on rather than playing catch up. We've always said, all Canadians view ourselves as an Arctic nation. Yeah, very few of us have ever been up into the Arctic. So we have to use it or lose it. And there is increased interest in the minerals and economic opportunities and natural resources in the Arctic region by a number of nations. With climate change, it becomes more accessible. And, you know, the Arctic winters are now becoming less and less of a threat for invading nations, as we want to put it in that term. And so we need to make the appropriate investments. And that's why heavy icebreakers in the Navy, not just the Arctic offshore patrol ships that we have now, which are doing great work, but we need to have increased capabilities in the Arctic. And heavy icebreakers is part of that, not just for the Coast Guard, but two ships for the Navy is what we're calling on. And making use of some existing facilities that we have, such as finishing off the Nanisivik Naval Station up on the north end of Baffin Island, which has been an ongoing build for the better part of the last decade. But let's finish it off in two decades. But actual construction going on for the last decade, and let's finish it off and get using it. Resolute Bay is a a base that you know has been picked up by Canadian forces that we could use as a NATO center of excellence for Arctic training to enable more capability across the NATO sphere, not just from a Canadian perspective. So let's work on that and make use of some of the other assets there, such as both the base, the Navy base, or not the port facilities that already exist, as well as the airfield that already exists up there. And then we're also saying is to reestablish a base at Churchill, Manitoba, which, you know, would provide us year-round operations within the Arctic. And, you know, that previously was an Army and Air Force base back in the Cold War in the 50s and 60s. But it also has a port there connected by rail, which makes it a central land connected facility that would make an excellent base for the Royal Canadian Navy to operate out of year round. And it's an investment that we think sends a strong message to our allies, but also to those that have growing interest in our Arctic, that we are prepared to defend our sovereignty, including the entire maritime region.
And then just lastly, one of the other commitments there is to refurbish, expand the forward operating locations for the Air Force in the North. And then both that initiative, as well as the two different naval facilities that you discussed, you're talking about having them potentially be dual use for the local economy. What's the intent with opening it up to other people in the North?
Well, it is about providing economic opportunity and connectivity for people in the Arctic region of Canada, that those that live and work in the territories will have more opportunities to be connected to the rest of Canada. So we have to upgrade our forward operation locations anyway. They're getting antiquated. They're originally built and thinking about the CF-18s. We now will be having new fighter jets that are bigger and faster, and regardless of which ones you're looking at, you're going to probably be looking at having to put in all new hangars with abilities to deal with the data dumps that come off these aircraft. So we have to change everything from the cybersecurity and the cyber connectivity of those airplanes and those forward operation locations to hangars, to runways. And if you're going to do that, then why not have it as an airfield that can also be used by the local community for commercial traffic? Case in point, we do that already in places like Comox and Trenton and Winnipeg, where the airfields are shared between National Defense and the regional airport authorities. So it's about taking that and expanding that opportunity. The same is true with the bases. If we're going to be, or the Navy bases, if we're going to be putting a pile of money into refurbishing docks and the ability to bring in big Navy ships, well, case in point is that you can also then bring in big commercial freighters as well. And Churchill already deals with, you know, big freighters coming in to pick up grain and other bulk cargo. So there's an opportunity to expand the purpose of the Port of Churchill as well as Nanisivik as places that we can move more commercial goods in and out of the region.
To cover off the eastern and western points of the globe, a bit about what you do with respect to NATO to the east across the Atlantic, as well as what the party would do if it forms government with respect to the Indo-Pacific region.
So NATO, you know, most important multinational alliance that Canada participates in, we will continue and expand our operations through NATO, especially in EFP Latvia. We'll ensure that we have the ability to expand air policing under the NATO Baltic air policing. We've participated that in the past, but we can actually increase our frequency and the amount of aircraft that we're committing to air policing under NATO. Operation Unifier with Ukraine, providing lethal weapons, reinstating the radar sat imagery to help monitor what's happening in Donbass and Crimea as the Russian invaders continue to occupy that sovereign territory of Ukraine. So it's about making sure that we continue to provide that deterrence through NATO against this Russian aggression that we're seeing throughout the eastern flank. and showing to our NATO allies that Canada under a Conservative government will be fully committed. Pivoting to the Pacific, the Indo-Pacific specifically, we want to join the Quad, the quadrilateral dialogue that happens between India, Japan, Australia, and the United States. We think that Canada has a major role to play there. We are a Pacific nation. We are concerned about our allies and other democratic nations in the region who are continuing to be bullied and geopolitical interference coming from the Communist Party of China and the regime in Beijing. So being there to stand with Japan and deter what's happening in Hong Kong and deter what's happening in Taiwan and building of islands in the South China Sea, these are things that we need to be there along with the Americans and other like-minded nations and cooperating on a more frequent basis. But that is why we need to have a more robust Navy. That's why we need to have increased fighter jets within Canadian Armed Forces that are modern and able to participate in these multilateral exercises as well as operations. And so whether it's under Canada belonging to Quad or under enhanced operations in NATO, we have to continue to be that reliable partner and one that always shows up when called upon, and that we can bring not just the greatest soldiers, air crew, and sailors in the world, but also come with capable equipment to do the job that they're tasked with.
Mr. Bazan, thanks for joining us to talk about the platform. The last question quickly before I let you go, what are you reading while you're campaigning?
Well, I'm, of course, reading Canada's recovery plan and, what we're doing to secure the future as Conservatives. I'm actually very excited about our platform. It is by far the most detailed platform we've ever brought forward. And, you look at our defense and foreign affairs planks that are in this platform, and it goes on for pages with a lot of detail. You compare that to the Liberals, and I think they got two or three paragraphs on national defense, and that's it. This is something that we take very seriously. It's about being there for all Canadians, and the peace and security that we all take for granted is only possible because of the brave men and women who serve in the Canadian Armed Forces and the strong alliances that we've been able to develop over generations with the Americans and our NATO allies, and of course those in the Pacific region. So this shows us how we're going to take those seriously, reestablish Canada as that trusted, reliable partner, and one that will have a strong voice at the international table when we talk about things like what's happening today in Afghanistan and how there was a lack of seriousness and disconnect with the Trudeau government to what was actually taking place on the ground. And it was too little too late at the end. And now we've got 1,200 Canadians and interpreters that are still in Afghanistan that are currently getting hunted down. And we have to get them to safety as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, they were left behind by Justin Trudeau.
Mr. Bazan, thank you very much for taking the time this morning. We know you have to get back to the campaign trail. Best of luck to you.
Thanks so much, David. Good seeing you.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/support. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producer, Charlotte Duval-Antoine, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.